The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu. Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
But what more can we do as a city? What more can we do as a community, as a state, or as a nation? We have a national epidemic on gun violence in America, and we have a serious problem with how we are treating mental health in this nation. One thing we know is that it doesn't have to be this way. Other nations have challenges with mental health, but they don't seem to have nearly the level of gun violence that we do in America. So it's the guns that we're talking about.
That is, of course, Atlanta Mayor Andre Dickens speaking last night upon the capture of a suspect and after a mass shooting that has so far has left one person dead and four others injured. From WABE in Atlanta, this is Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. A tense-filled day in the city, as yes, another mass shooting occurs, this time within Atlanta's Midtown neighborhood. We'll get to that in just a moment. We will tell you what's coming up later on the program. Chandra Farley, Atlanta's new chief sustainability officer, talks about the city's goal to run 100% of Atlanta on 100% clean energy, as well as other practical sustainable initiatives for Atlanta. Also, the mission of the John and Lillian Miles Lewis Foundation, they're passing the torch to a new generation. Now, those conversations coming up, but we begin with the last 24 hours here in Atlanta.
We know that shortly before noon, the subject entered into 1110 West Peachtree Street and went to a medical center inside the building. It was shortly thereafter that he shot our first victim, and then the first 911 call came after that.
That's Deputy Chief Charles Hampton from the Atlanta Police Department's Criminal Investigations Department. Five women were shot: Amy St. Pierre, Lisa Glenn, Georgetta Whitlow, Jasmine Daniel, and Alicia Hollinger. 39-year-old Amy St. Pierre was killed. She worked for the CDC. In a statement from the CDC that reads in part, quote, "The CDC is deeply saddened by the unexpected loss of a colleague killed yesterday in the Midtown Atlanta shooting. Our hearts are with her family, friends, and colleagues as they remember her and grieve this tragic loss," close quote. Now, at the time of this original broadcast, which is at 1 p.m., here's the latest on the other four victims. From Grady Hospital, just moments ago, Dr. Robert Jensen, who's the chief medical officer.
As of today, three of them are in intensive care unit. One of them is in stable condition in one of our medical units. Two of the three in critical care are going back to the operating room today for additional procedures. The third patient is stable. Hopefully, we'll be able to move out of the ICU today. I have had the opportunity to speak to either the family or the victims today. The families are incredibly appreciative of the support they've received, not only from the hospital, from the community itself. And the victims with whom I was able to speak have expressed the same thing. So as of right now, everybody is as stable as they can be given the nature of their injuries.
Now back to yesterday. As public safety alerts began, multiple law enforcement agencies began working together as the search began for the suspect. Here's Atlanta Police Department Chief Darren Schierenbaum.
On the earliest views from the crime scene, you saw not only the Atlanta Police Department responding, you saw a network of officers representing multiple agencies who have trained for this various outcome. Mr. Mayor, over and over again, that a day that this tragedy should befall the city, that we would be ready. And I stand here today to tell you that the First Responder Network was there today for their city. The Sheriff of Fulton County, Sheriff Labatt, the Georgia State Patrol, the MARTA Police Department, Georgia Tech Police Department, Georgia State University, Marshals, they were all on scene quickly, executing their active shooter protocol to stop this situation. And then very shortly, we were joined by the GBI, the FBI, the Secret Service, as well as United States Marshal Service, as we sought to bring this person into custody. And that investigation soon showed us that this perpetrator had left the city.
Now, that search would leave Atlanta and end in Cobb County. Technology would be key in tracking and eventually locating the suspect. From Cobb County, it's Police Chief Stuart Van Hoser.
If you rewind the hand of time 4 years, we probably would not be where we are today right now. Technology played a huge role, but technology doesn't do any good without people who are determined to capture an individual that would do something like this. And today we saw where those two things came together in an amazing way.
Now, that technology included license plates readers, security cameras, and transit technology used by the Department of Transportation. 24-year-old Deion Patterson would be taken into custody. At the time of this broadcast, we do know that Patterson has waived his first appearance. And finally, this morning, Atlanta Mayor Andre Dickens issued a letter to the city. Quote, "This is a moment for healing as a community, but it is also a moment that calls us to action. Atlanta's a group project. Just as we came together yesterday to respond to this shooting, we must now come together with resolve to each do our parts to stop these horrific events from happening again, whether here in Atlanta or anywhere in our country." You hear more later from last night's press conference with Mayor Dickens later in the program. Also later, Atlanta City Council President Doug Shipman joins Closer Look with more regarding how the city and other agencies came together and responded to yesterday's mass shooting. You're listening to Closer Look.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
And Closer Look continues from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. During this year's State of the City address, Mayor Andre Dickens included this.
Thanks to our partners in D.C., Senators Ossoff and Warnock and Congresswoman Williams, we have attracted more than $100 million in additional federal investments in our roads, the airport, and in transit. All these investments must be done with an eye towards building a clean energy city. We're working with our Clean Energy Advisory Board, including representatives from our most energy-burdened neighborhoods, to reach our goal of 100% clean energy for 100% of Atlantans.
So, what's the timeline for this sustainability goal, and how does the city plan to accomplish it? Those measures will fall directly under the leadership within the city's Office of Sustainability and Resiliency and the chief officer, and that person is Chandra Farley, who joins me now. Welcome to the program. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Good afternoon, Rose.
Good afternoon. I want to begin. We're going to get to our conversation, but, you know, we obviously had a horrific incident yesterday in our city, and I wanted to give you an opportunity to offer any reflection that you want to at this moment.
Thank you for that. My heart remains heavy, definitely weary at the news of this, another tragedy of a mass shooting, this time again in Midtown where I live. I live on 14th Street. I was actually in Little Rock, Arkansas for the Southeast Sustainability Director's annual meeting with my Deputy Chief Sustainability Officer, John R. Seidel, and the news started coming in right as we were boarding. So when we returned to Atlanta, I couldn't get home. I had an event in Buckhead that evening, but last night for that event and this afternoon, it has been a blessing to share space with dreamers and doers across this city who are committed to, making sure Atlanta lives up to its claims and its aims. Mm-hmm. So thank you for opening up space to acknowledge that.
Absolutely. Now let's get to, you know, what you were appointed to do. You know, often we hear about these chief officers of this and chief officer of that. And I want to give you an opportunity to tell Atlanta what that really means for you when we talk about, you know, the cities and the overall initiative and the overall goal. It's, look, it's the Office of Sustainability and Resiliency. You know, for someone listening says, okay, what does that mean? You're going to make sure that we all have clean air and environmental standards are met, and it all lies with you. And if something goes wrong, then you're the person that we look to say, hey, what happened?
Absolutely. So I'm not the only person that people need to look to. But yes, as the Chief Sustainability Officer for the City of Atlanta, my charge is to address the inequitable effects of climate change. And that includes addressing energy insecurity, healthy housing, food systems, local food systems, waste diversion, building efficiency, workforce training and minority business development opportunities related to those sectors, fleet electrification, EV charging infrastructure community-wide. So those are all things that my office, the Office of Sustainability and Resilience, focuses on. Mm-hmm. And so I am a mayor's office. Mm-hmm. Officially, we were officially codified as the Mayor's Office of Sustainability and Resilience in December 2022. So that really speaks to Mayor Dickens' leadership to re-elevate this office. Mm-hmm. The Chief Sustainability Officer position was re-elevated to a cabinet level position. So that is really important because all of those topics, including others that I mentioned, mm-hmm. happen in direct partnership with our departments.
Go ahead.
So it's just, as a mayor's office, we can set policies, we develop plans, mm-hmm. We set targets like our 100% clean energy plan, but the implementation of that work, the actual physical, tangible implementation of those goals and strategies happens in deep partnership and in direct relationship with our operating departments like watershed, mm-hmm. parks, enterprise asset management, fleet services, public works, to name a few.
And so I'm curious, because you were appointed, I believe, in August of last year. So I imagine you came in, wanted to do an assessment of the department. And then how did you prioritize? What were you going to tackle? Or what were you assessing in that first, I guess, month that you were in this position? What were you looking to analyze, so to speak?
Yes. So I was appointed in September. My first day was like September 29. So I'm going into my seventh month. So while I was new to the City of Atlanta in this position, mm-hmm. I've been in partnership with the previous iterations of the city's sustainability and resilience offices for at least a decade. This was as a technical assistance partner during my 8 years at South Face Institute, as a community-based organization partner during 3 years at Partnership for Southern Equity. So I felt like I had a good handle on what we needed to do, but of course you don't know what you don't know. Mm-hmm. So I came into the position with a 30, 60, 90 day strategy focused on what you are talking about. Where are things? What has been stalling and why? Because I joined in the first year of Mayor Dickens' administration. Mm-hmm. So there was, we were still doing a lot of transition work just to his transition team and how he was establishing his cabinet and establishing his priorities. Mm-hmm. I had to get real familiar with that. I had to quickly learn the legislative process with the city.
I bet that was an eye opener, huh?
a very, very eye opening. So it has been good so far, because learning those processes and procedures, the relationship building, I also wanted to make sure that one of my first steps were who are those primary departmental partners, mm-hmm. Primary cabinet members that I need to be partnered with. And those include many of those that I mentioned, from watershed to mm-hmm. parks, public works are key. So that was really what I was focused on, just getting a lay of the land. And we had a few things, again, that had been stalled that I needed to get up to speed on to begin moving forward.
And for our listeners, you know, coming into this and talking about, listen, Atlanta has this goal of 100% of Atlanta on 100% clean energy. I guess the first question would be, is that doable?
It is possible.
Possible.
Yes, it is possible in a lot of different ways. Mm-hmm. So many cities, stepped out and committed to 100% clean energy commitments. This was driven a lot by a Sierra Club campaign, the Ready for 100 campaign, that pushed to have over 100 cities, probably even more now at this point, commit their cities to 100% clean energy. A lot of those cities, I think including the city of Atlanta, committed to that without knowing exactly how that was going to happen. But that was the beginning of our development of our 100% clean energy Atlanta plan. So there are a number of different pathways. We passed our... Well, City Council adopted our clean energy plan in 2019. Mm-hmm. There were very key targets related to how we would meet those goals. So when City Council adopted the plan, they also adopted interim targets. Mm-hmm. So for instance, our next interim target is to get 30% towards that goal by 2025, then 50% by 2030, with the goal of reaching 100% by 2035. Mm-hmm. So really what we are doing right now, our clean energy plan was set up to be reviewed and updated every 3 years. It was set up that way to align with our utility regulatory cycle in front of the Public Service Commission. And so that is what we are working on right now. The clip that you played of the mayor from the State of the City talking about our Clean Energy Advisory Board is a key advisor on that. And that is what we will be focused on with all the technology changes, with all the federal funding opportunities, with all of the new corporate partnerships who also have 100% clean energy goals across the city that are housed here. So that's what we're focused on right now, is updating that path.
If you're just joining us, I'm in conversation with Atlanta's chief officer in the Office of Sustainability, Chandra Farley. Now, there is so much tied to when we talk about sustainability initiatives, whether you're talking about vehicles, whether you're talking about buildings, but a big piece of it that people are really focused on is the equity piece in all of this. And you heard the mayor talk about in certain parts of the community where they may be lacking in some of these initiatives. What is your approach to this equity piece being in all of that?
Absolutely. So I firmly believe there is no sustainability without equity. If it's not equitable, it's not sustainable. So that is a baseline. And so where I come from sustainability, really one is a grounding in the indigenous philosophy of sustainability and the seven generations principle, that the decisions we make today should result in a sustainable world seven generations into the future. And I think that grounding is really important to be justice led. That is definitely my path, coming from a very civil rights minded, justice focused family and rooting all of the initiatives, programs, and policies that we move forward with the Office of Sustainability and Resilience have to be rooted in environmental justice. Mm-hmm. And that is really where we begin to make sure that we are addressing racial equity, making sure that the decisions that we make are prioritizing communities who are already disproportionately impacted by a changing climate due to systemic racism, like racist federal policy, like redlining. Mm-hmm. So we know that here in the city of Atlanta, we unfortunately carry not recognition isn't the right word, but as the fourth, as a city with the fourth highest energy burden, mm-hmm. In the country of sizes that are similar. And energy burden means that it's the ratio of your monthly household mm-hmm. income to your utility bills. Uh-huh. So the lower your income, the higher your utility bills, the higher your energy burden. Mm-hmm. And through some studies from Georgia Tech and GreenLink Analytics, we know that here in the city of Atlanta, out of the 27 zip codes in the city, there are six concentrated in Southwest Atlanta that carry energy burdens that are 3 to 5 times higher than the wider, wealthier zip codes to the north of the city. And when we're talking about energy burden, we are talking about that means that you are dedicating about 6% mm-hmm. of your income to utility bills.
So what can you all do about it? What do you think all can do?
I actually just came from a really exciting peer learning session. And one of the things that we are doing here in the city is launching a program called Weatherize ATL. Mm-hmm. This will be focused on those energy burdened communities that I talked about and basically just fixing the buildings. You know, mm-hmm. people hear me talk about fixing the buildings because one of the other reasons that those energy burdens are so high for Atlanta and in the South is because it's hot down here. Mm-hmm. So people are, you know, blowing air conditioning, you know, in the summer, and homes and buildings in communities that have been historically disinvested in have poor infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So you've got to crank up the air more because you've got cracks in your windows mm-hmm. or, you know, you don't have insulation in your attic or, you know, you've got air leaking out of different places. So we are going to be working with 3 nonprofit partners to deliver through funding from the American Rescue Plan Act funds to make homes across the city with the focus on those most energy burdened communities more energy efficient. And the mayor has set forth a goal for Atlanta to reduce those energy burdens by mm-hmm. 10%. And so that is what we are going to be focused on, hoping to, once that those approvals move through that legislative process mm-hmm. that I'm still learning about, we hope to be launching that program in the summer.
And part of this too, part of your work and some of the initiatives, and folks may not understand it, so now we're going to talk about it, because it includes creating the first comprehensive food systems plan for underserved communities. What does that effort look like? And explain to our listeners who may not understand or make the connection when we talk about sustainability and all this, and why this is so important.
I think something that I always come back to, particularly with sustainability and some of the disconnect that we feel, particularly in marginalized communities, you know, I talk about everybody remembers like their grandmama, their auntie saying, shut that door, you're letting mm-hmm. my air out. Turn that light off before you leave the room. Don't leave that water running or quit running in and out of my house.
I know I heard it.
Yeah, right. That is sustainability. Those mm-hmm. are conservation strategies. Mm-hmm. Those are energy efficiency strategies. But what we have come to is that sustainability has been in a lot of energy efficiency has been repackaged and sold back to the very communities who innovated these strategies out of necessity and survival. And now they've been repackaged in a really confusing utility program or a really confusing federal program that they don't know how to access, that requires 12 pages of, you know, of an application to prove this, that, and the other that you're eligible for these programs. So a lot of my work and a lot of where I come from and much of the work that we do with our community-based organizations and community partners across the city is just building awareness. Mm-hmm. You know, we will never be able to do enough education around what it means to be sustainable. Mm-hmm. When we are talking about being sustainable, we are talking about having a healthier home. Mm-hmm. We are talking about addressing childhood asthma. Mm-hmm. We are talking about community wealth building through the job opportunities that come through energy efficiency, mm-hmm. that come through weatherization, because this is HVAC. This is plumbing. Mm-hmm. These are contractors who blow insulation. Mm-hmm. And so these are job and workforce development opportunities, but these are also minority business development opportunities. So while we are addressing the technical issues and the physical infrastructure of the homes, we are at the same time creating economic opportunities mm-hmm. for communities who have been and are in danger of continuing to be left behind by what we hear talked about as the clean energy transition or the transition to a clean energy economy.
And so understanding that for households with maybe their low wage earners, if you have to spend more money on energy related issues, and perhaps that takes away from or that directly impacts decisions you make in terms of the type of food that you buy. You know, maybe it impacts the healthcare choices or, you know, health and wellness choices you make. So what you're saying, all this is connected.
Absolutely. This is the ecosystem of our lives. This is why the built environment and why I'm so passionate about buildings. I come from a buildings background because when we talk about buildings, when we talk about our homes, we have to talk about the people because that's who's in the buildings. And when we talk about the people, we have to talk about, well, how do they get home? How do they get to their place of work? Which leads us to a conversation about transportation, which is our city's second largest source of emissions. And then when we talk about commercial buildings, small commercial buildings, our recreation centers, then we talk about what role and what purpose do these buildings serve in community? So we can begin a lot of conversations and begin to chart a path to address a lot of the ills and inequalities and inequities related to sustainability and addressing community resilience just by talking about environments where we live, work, play, and pray.
And so finally, as we wrap up, and we're going to actually, we want to bring you back because we want to make sure our listeners are following you along this process. Where is Atlanta right now in this process? I know you've done the assessment. You've talked about that. You've talked about some priorities, some initiatives. So now is it just implementation or here comes the big money question? Do you need the funding? You know, folks like you, when y'all get that money question, you're like, oh, yeah, Rose, here we go. What's next here?
Yes, absolutely. So one, where are we in our goals? So we've just finished an assessment and we're about 13% of the way towards that 30% interim goal. Mm-hmm. And what's important to remember about that, the city of Atlanta is served by our utility, Georgia Power. Mm-hmm. And so their energy mix is our energy mix. So that is why focusing on buildings and energy efficiency is so important because we have to reduce our energy consumption as much as possible while at the same time trying to build up more renewable energy sources. So we have the largest municipal solar program in the state. We have solar on 23 of our municipal buildings. So that is helping us reduce our greenhouse gas emissions and create healthier environments around those facilities. So that's where we are. The money question is always there. We are looking definitely at the historic federal funding through the climate legislation from the Biden-Harris administration. Mm-hmm. There are a number of opportunities that we're looking at. We're partnering with the Atlanta Department of Transportation on a number of opportunities and also with our Department of Enterprise Asset Management to focus on our municipal building stock for the city. And the dollars are out there for federal funding, but it takes a long time to get some of this money, Rose, from these federal funding.
I have heard, and I also have heard, you know, I want to be fair too, that when some departments have got the money, they've been slow in terms of trying to disperse it. But I'm not saying that's your department. I'm just saying it's, you know, you hear both sides. Slow to get the money, then you get the money, then, you know, then you got to send the money back or it's. I have a feeling you're not going to be sending any money back to them.
Oh, no, ma'am. You didn't know. You do not have to worry about that with that. So that's why the planning and partnerships, our cross-departmental and interdepartmental partnerships are so important. We're learning these processes. A lot of the federal government is learning alongside with us. Mm-hmm. We have really great relationships, like with the Department of Energy, DOT, our Region 4 EPA Administrator, Daniel Blackman. So mm-hmm. we stay in constant communication to make sure that we are maximizing our opportunities. And in the interim, you know, we need our philanthropic community to step up. I was at an event last night and, you know, the philanthropic community always wants to know, well, how can we help? How can we help fill the gap? You know, pick something and fill the gap.
And look, as someone just emailed me and said, Rose, we need more EV charging stations. So that's a whole nother conversation, but we'll bring you back to talk about that.
I would love to. I would love to. That's another federal funding opportunity that we are going after. And I think it's really important to say that we are fully aligned in my office and the city with the Biden-Harris Justice 40 initiative, which is to make sure that 40% of the benefits of these federal investments are directed to our most historically disinvested communities. So that is a lens that I am carrying, and the city council actually adopted thanks to the support and push of some of our environmental justice partner organizations in the city. We have a Justice 40 Oversight Commission.
Right.
So that's going to be really important as we work together over these next few months as dollars start to flow to the city and to the Office of Sustainability and Resilience to implement these initiatives and ambitious goals.
All right. Chandra Fawley, Chief Sustainability Officer for the City of Atlanta. Isn't this much better than running for office? Thank you so much for taking it. Thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. Good information. We'll have you back. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
We're not safe at concerts. We're not safe at banks. We're not safe at parades. We're not safe in our own yards and in our own homes. And now, today, we can add medical facilities to that list. And still, we have done so very little.
That is Georgia Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock speaking on the Senate floor yesterday upon getting the news of another mass shooting, of course, this time taking place in Atlanta. Now, a closer look will continue in just a moment when we explore the mission of the John and Lillian Miles Lewis Foundation. But we wanted to welcome in Atlanta City Council President Doug Shipman to offer his reflection as well. President Shipman, thank you for taking the time. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Rose. It's obviously a tough day. But I'm glad to be here to talk to it.
So much is being talked about and should be in terms of the response of the multi-law enforcement agencies. Obviously, they plan, they prepare for active shooters. This has become a norm in our society. Just your thoughts on overall what happened yesterday and Atlanta's response and the other agencies.
Well, obviously, this was a horrible situation. You had a gunman in a medical office open fire very quickly when that call came in. Multiple officers responded to the scene. Obviously, when he fled, then there was an activation of the camera network to try to understand where he was going. And then as basically his vehicle was tracked up to Cobb County, then Cobb County was engaged. But in addition, both the state and federal authorities were also involved. So it was across jurisdictions, it was use of technology, it was use of people. And then also a lot of credit goes to the EMS folks and to Grady Hospital, who immediately were caring for the victims. So this took a lot of coordination. This is really an example of how complicated these situations can be. And also, I just have to thank everybody in Midtown who was willing to stay in place, to stay safe. A lot of people were locked down for several hours, which is horrible. But, you know, we didn't have any further loss of life, which is really, really grateful for.
And I also want to address it's the public city alerts. Now, obviously, we in the media, we were doing our part here at WABE, trying to just really tell people as we were getting the information in. How do you assess in terms of the city being able to inform its residents? And I know you all rely on the media, but I know we get those amber alerts and things like that. Was there any other type of, and we get pollen, you know, pollution alerts as well. Any other alerts that could have been handled differently, you think, in terms of notifying the city, President Shipman?
So people can sign up for Notify ATL alerts. Those are alerts of all kinds. They can be weather alerts. They can be security alerts. So that system was active, but you do have to sign up for that.
So you have to sign up for it. You have to sign up for it.
Okay. That's right. And then there are other mechanisms like the Amber Alert system and such. I think this was a difficult one yesterday. Certainly we will reflect on how it went and we'll try to learn from it. But this was difficult because you knew where the initial action had happened, mm-hmm. but then we did not know where the person was. Mm-hmm. And so in an abundance of caution, you know, the public safety folks were trying to find him, but also trying to keep everyone safe. And so that's why you had the shelter in place. That's why you had some of those situations for a few hours. So we'll reflect on it and try to learn from it so that people are informed in real time.
And then also we know that particularly here, because of the location of where all this took place, and APS did a really good job in trying to let parents know, particularly for those students at Midtown High School. And then mm-hmm. I think Emin is not too far from there and other, I believe it was a great Midtown High, maybe Washington,
right,
that might have been impacted. So really, when you look at so many different agencies and entities having to coordinate and work together with something, with an incident that was still developing, you have to say that, you would say Atlanta really responded pretty well here. Yeah. I don't know where you can find fault with anyone.
No, I think that there is a lot of credit to go around. And also, one of the other things that this really showcases, you know, one of the things, you go all the way back to 9/11, there were issues with communications across fire department, police department, radios not matching, all of those kinds of things. There have been a lot of investments in those basic kinds of coordination technologies over time. And I think you saw that yesterday. Mm-hmm. All of those different entities were able to coordinate with each other, were able to keep each other updated so that you did have schools feeling comfortable making the decisions that they needed to make to keep kids safe, having, you know, between Cobb County and Atlanta and understanding, you know, who was going to be in front given where we thought the suspect was. So, yes, I think there's a lot of credit to go around. I think this is a good example of a lot of work that's been done, right? The work to make that kind of situation go well happens in the months and years between these incidents.
And President Shipman, again, whenever we have these mass shootings, and the mayor talked about it in penning his letter to the city, and he ended up talking about it's all about guns. And you look at the fact that Atlanta has a lot of festivals. We love our festivals, right? I love the festivals. And then you look at one that's going to be coming up later in the year, the one Music Fest taking place at Piedmont Park. You know, concerns about, you know, what can the city of Atlanta do to ensure or better ensure safety as it relates to people might, you know, because now we have a state law, people, you know, permitless carry. Does this also bring this conversation back up to the forefront about what can we do in some of these public spaces like this?
I certainly think it has to. The state leadership, the governor signed a new bill lessening restrictions this year. The state legislature has consistently made either it easier to buy guns, easier to carry guns, or harder for the police to enforce, trying to ascertain whether or not someone should have a gun. Mm-hmm. We live in a very open state. Mm-hmm. And because of that, one, I think we have to ask, is that the right policy? Is that keeping us safe or not? And two, then have to revisit how we think about, you know, some of the public spaces. There's no question that it has to bring up that kind of conversation. Because at the end of the day, an incident like this isn't just about the loss of life that we had, which is awful. It's not just about the victims, but it's the fact that everyone now is looking over their shoulder, right? As Senator Warnock said, and he's exactly right. Now, when you go to the doctor's office, you're going to be thinking, hey, is this secured? Should it be secured? Do I feel safe? And that permeates our society. And so I think we have to ask the questions, are our policies making us safer or not?
Well, what can you all do at the city council level when you are up against a state statute that has been approved by the General Assembly and signed by the governor? Is it time to try to have some other conversations, or where do you go from here?
Well, I think on the policy perspective, it is difficult, and that is, you know, that is the state's jurisdiction. I do think this incident yesterday also showcases that we know we have more work to do around mental health, around mental health caregiving. That is something that the state has begun to move on. I think there's much more to do. We know we don't have enough mental health care providers in the state. But on the local level, to for us to be asking the questions, are we doing all the things that we can do? And that goes down to things like recreation centers. It goes down to when the police, you know, when 911 gets a call about someone in a mental health crisis, are we responding in the appropriate ways? Are we tracking that? Do we have counselors as well as public safety officers? You know, I think at the local level, we can grapple with, in part, with that mental health aspect. But from a gun policy perspective, I think we have to continue to advocate and have to continue to ask questions.
Atlanta City Council President Doug Shipman, as always, we appreciate you taking the time. Thank you.
Thanks, Rose.
And Closer Look continues now from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. The mission of the John and Lillian Miles Lewis Foundation shouldn't be surprising. At the core, well, they want to pass the torch to the next generation with hopes of sharing what the civil rights giant, John Lewis, Congressman, and his lovely wife, Lillian, what they were all about, their passion for what they call purposeful living. Well, it also includes now the foundation had its inaugural multi-city student civil rights tour. And we're going to learn more about it now with Leslie Schaefer, a social studies instructor, AP and humanities specialist, and the social department chair of the Drew Charter School, and D'Angelo Taylor, an 11th grader at Drew Charter School. They both join me. Thank you for taking the time. Welcome.
We are happy to be here.
All right. You know, D'Angelo, I'm going to start with you. Tell me what you know about Congressman John Lewis.
Actually, I met Congressman John Lewis back in second grade.
Wow.
He came to our school to, if I remember correctly, he came to our school to talk to us as second graders about what it's like being a congressman and being a Black man in America, essentially preparing us for our future at such a young age. And he was overall, from what I know about him, he was just a good soul.
Yeah.
Like, he was just a great person.
A good soul. Leslie Schaefer, when you hear a student like D'Angelo talking about remembering this from, what do you say, second grade? Yeah. What is that? How does that resonate with you?
I think to me, that speaks to Congressman Lewis's impact and his spirit. I never had the opportunity to meet Congressman Lewis, but at every stop on the tour, we met people who knew him personally. And the stories were the same, you know, and as a historian, you corroborate with that's how you create a narrative. You back up with actual evidence. And every single person said the same thing. He was kind. He was passionate about children. He was passionate about activism. He was passionate about truth and honesty and making the world a better place and taking the steps necessary to do that. Every person that we talked to spoke about his smile and how his smile, you know, that's one of the things they distinctly remember about him. The way people spoke about their interactions with him and in such a reverent way speaks to him as a person, as well as his legacy.
And so this was a tour. This was a 3-day tour, all expenses paid trip. I know, as someone with nieces and nephews, I love all expenses paid by somebody else. I know what that means during spring break. So I'm going to get to D'Angelo in a moment. But so these were students from Atlanta and was it Virginia?
Yeah. So Virginia was the John R. Lewis High School in Virginia. They, of course, traveled a little bit farther and we were able to experience this together. And it was actually really a really great opportunity because at Drew Charter, we have a strong focus on experiential and project-based learning. They have a strong leadership curriculum. We've actually found ways to help one another and ways to team up and collaborate, which is a partnership that, you know, would not have happened organically without this tour.
And so where did you all stop? Where were these civil rights tours? So what were the stops
So we went to the national peace, the Memorial for Peace and Justice, mm-hmm. with the Equal Justice Initiative. Mm-hmm. We went to the Rosa Parks Museum, the Freedom Writers Museum, the Civil Rights Museum. I think for me, the two stops that were the most impactful were visiting the Lewis family home, mm-hmm. and getting to meet his family,
yeah.
And to see the chicken coop where he preached to the chickens.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That was really wonderful. And the other, I think probably, and this was a bucket list moment, and I just found out from him, we have both with the same kind of, I think, take favorite moment, and that was crossing the Edmund Pettus, mm-hmm. Bridge.
D'Angelo, what about you? You went on this civil rights tour. You saw a lot. What stands out to you? What will you remember?
I honestly, I'm going to remember the whole tour. Yeah. I think the thing that stood out to me the most about the tour was like all of the museums, specifically the Legacy Museum, which was the first one we stopped at. Mm-hmm. It was just so powerful in a way. Of Black history in chronological order. You walk in and the first thing you're going to see is just explaining the slave trade and how our ancestors were taken from Africa and put here. Mm-hmm. But as you walk, you just see it starts with the slave trade, then it goes into slavery, and then it goes into Reconstruction, and then it goes into modern. And it's, mm-hmm. just everything is in like this order where you can really gauge all of Black history, mm-hmm. unfiltered in this one museum.
And D'Angelo, there are other students. What were some of the conversations you all had among yourselves that you can share as you're experiencing this and the emotions involved?
Well, in the museum, we really didn't talk to each other much because, mm-hmm. you're in a museum. It's not about conversating. But after the museums, we'd always go back to our hotel where we were staying and we'd have a bit of debriefs. Mm-hmm. A common theme that I heard between like all of my classmates was they were all just kind of shocked at how much they didn't know about Black history and how bad it actually really was, mm-hmm. and how not long ago this was happening.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So Leslie Schaefer, based on what we just heard from D'Angelo, and we're in a space now where there's all this conversation about how history should be told. Who should tell, mm-hmm. it? What should be left out? Just your thoughts on that, and then you connect that to what D'Angelo just said. There was a lot that we didn't know.
He's 100% right about there are political conversations about the narratives of history. They are putting teachers and students in a position of becoming political footballs that we don't deserve to be. Mm-hmm. Children deserve the unvarnished truth. They deserve the tools. They deserve teachers who will provide them with the critical thinking skills to navigate through hard history, and that should be included, as easily as possible and with as much resilience as possible. Mm. So when he says that, and we talked about this on the trip, it's, you know, there are a lot of handcuffs that we have that I wish we didn't have, mm-hmm. as educators. And, you know, if I could, you know, even, you know, I always tell them all the time, I don't have enough time. I just don't have enough time. I don't, yeah. have enough time. I wish I had more time, to go beyond the traditional, mm. and allow us to explore and learn together.
D'Angelo, what do you want to say to someone who may have an opportunity to go on this tour and maybe they're not sure, but other students, what do you want to let them know about this?
Do it. There's nothing you shouldn't, like when it comes to even as a non-Black student, you should be excited, not necessarily excited, but you should be willing to learn Black history. And if it's an all expenses paid trip, you lose nothing and you get to see all of these museums, you get to see all of these buildings, you get to see the bridge, the churches, you get to go visit John Lewis's family. It's a very eye-opening experience. and that I wouldn't really recommend nobody. Yeah.
No, no, go ahead.
I wouldn't recommend anybody turns that experience down. It's just, it's completely, you win.
All right. Leslie Schaefer, for educators out there who have an opportunity, what do you want them to know?
Never turn down an opportunity to engage in experiential learning with your students. It's having the opportunity to touch the Brown AME Church, to walk across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. D'Angelo, we were talking about the crossing the bridge and recreating that walk. Mm-hmm. He led. Mm. And another chaperone and I were at the very back. Mm. And to put yourself in that position, to really think about and empathize and engage in historical empathy, it makes it real in a way that textbooks simply just cannot do.
That's a great way to end this conversation, the way textbooks cannot do. Leslie Schaefer from Drew Charter School and D'Angelo Taylor, an 11th grader. Now, we might as well call you a senior now because school's almost out. So are you starting to think about what's next after high school, D'Angelo? I don't want to put you on the spot, but you know.
I mean, well, I know that I want to go to college, obviously, either for political science or music education. Definitely going to try to get to Clark Atlanta, but we don't really know yet.
You will. How about that? You will go to college. We know that, right? We know that. So we got your back on that. Thank you so much, Leslie and D'Angelo. Thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. Good conversation. I'm glad you all had that opportunity on that civil rights tour. Leslie, I have a listener says, well, how can anyone go on this, or do schools have to sign up for it? What do you suggest they do to find out more information?
I suggest they contact the John and Lillian Miles Lewis Foundation.
Okay.
They're because they are committed to supporting, you know, youth and civil rights education and experiential education.
All right. Well, we'll do that. Thank you so much for taking time. I really appreciate it. Best of luck to you both.
Thank you so much.
And that is it for this edition of Closer Look. Our producers are Daniel Razel and LaShawn Hudson. Tiffany Griffith is our supervising producer. Our engineer is Sawyer Vanderwerth. A reminder to let us know your thoughts on today's program or any other, send me an email. It's really easy, rose@wabe.org. And if you missed any of today's program, it's online. It's always online. wabe.org/closerlook. And of course, you can listen to Closer Look weeknights at 7 p.m. as well as in our podcast. So subscribe to Closer Look wherever you like. Stay tuned to WABE from Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Local, state, national politics. WABE and NPR have the coverage you need. I'm Jim Burris, host of WABE's All Things Considered. Whether it's on the air at 90.1, streaming online, or connecting through our mobile app, WABE keeps you on top of election 2024 in what's sure to be a pivotal year in politics. And for candidates and ballot information, visit our election hub at wabe.org/election2024.